Do you mind?
I was doing that on purpose.
I know you are because you're annoying. Stop.
You know, I went and got my nails done today.
I don't care. I don't care that you got your nails done, because after you just sat here and crumpled a bottle in my ear.
Actually, shouldn't do that bad.
All right. Are you done?
It's like a soft call.
You're still going. Like, you're still going. Like, this is a normal conversation.
Lord, all I'm asking is bless this bread, bless this meat, and bless my stomach, cause I was going to eat.
Amen. Howdy there. Welcome to To and Fro, a podcast from two Black Southern Queens. I'm Dalia.
And I'm Jackie. And on today's episode, we're going to talk about soul food, or ethnic cuisine, or African-American cuisine, whichever you prefer. We're going to talk about some of the unknown history and some popular concepts of it today versus what is actually true.
We also talk about the movie Soul Food and Jackie's theory of how Big Mama led to her own demise. I'm sorry, y'all.
It's not a theory. It's okay. A fact. Right. She killed herself.
Okay, Jackie.
Because she continued to eat the food, Jackie, that killed her and didn't take her insulin.
Okay, we can, so we can get theory? Into that. That's a no, fact. It's okay. We can get into that after this.
Just don't. Okay. Cool. Whatever.
Jackie, so what does soul food or African American cuisine mean to you?
Okay, so when I first think of soul food, I think of greens off the top because that's my favorite. Like, greens are my favorite. But it also kind of reminds me of just like family, because when you're cooking, you're never cooking just for yourself. Like, someone's always going to stop by the house to get a plate. It's always just bringing each other together and just that feeling of what it brings. What about you?
Yeah, the same. Like you said, like family, it reminds me of love, and then it reminds me of naps as well. But speaking of greens, you know, weird fact is that some people in my family actually eat greens and cornbread with their fingers. Like, they said that, like, it's not meant to be eaten with a fork. And I don't know. Like, I don't know if you've ever heard of that in your family, but, like, that's a country thing that I've always grown up with.
I've mostly seen that more within, like, African culture.
Yeah, exactly. Right.
Like, I know, like, yeah, a lot of them, they just pick up their food, like some Nigerian food, also Indian food.
Yeah.
A lot of the time you just pick it up with your hands because, you know, it wasn't like naan and stuff like that. So I don't think that's too out of the ordinary.
Yeah, that's true, too.
But do they put cornbread in milk and eat it?
I've seen it before. It's actually really good. Have you ever tried it?
Yes. Duh. What?
It's delicious. What?
Like, girl, of course. Of course. I think that soul food is such an objective term. And you talked to Angela Medeiros, also known as the Kitchen Diva. She's a self-made chef. She's written 7 cookbooks with healthy African-American cuisine recipes and more than 100 children's books, mostly focusing on Black children.
Doesn't she sound absolutely amazing?
Not only does she sound amazing, I'm pretty sure she is.
Yes, and I not only got to interview her, but also she made me shrimp and grits.
Okay, so 3/4 cups of grits. That's not right. And this measuring cup, I should retire it. Bless its heart. It's had a long, hard life. Let's see. That's not even close. Almost there. Okay, now we're there. Okay. And then, so we're going to make enough servings for 4 people. Because okay. This is what Michael Medeiros, my husband, is going to have for dinner tonight.
Okay.
three cups of water. And the best way to make grits is to create a double boiler, because a lot of people buy the wrong kind of grits. You need at least 5-minute grits. Mm-hmm. Those 1-minute grits aren't going to give you the creaminess and the mouth feel that you want. Mm-hmm. Ooh, put a little more water in there. So this double boiler, as you said, it's nothing fancy. Some people buy a double boiler, but it's just 2 pots. Mm-hmm. One that has water in it. You really don't want the bottom of the pot wet. Mm-hmm. So I'm going to pour some of this water out. Mm-hmm. And what it does is it allows you to cook the grits for a long time without them sticking to the bottom of the pan. So it's kind of a gentle cook, because even though it says 5 minutes, you need to cook it longer than that in order to really get a good consistency. Okay. So we got in the double boiler. We're going to put the 3 cups of water in the pan. We're going to put a lid on it because it boils faster with the lid. And we're peace out until it comes to a boil, so we can move on to the next thing. You want to start from the beginning while the grits are
Start from the beginning.
Okay, so soul food is the food of the South. I mean, after the Civil War, everybody was eating whatever they could. So you can't say that soul food is only for African Americans. It wasn't. It was just the food of survival. It was what you ate because there was nothing else to eat. This is what you were given, and you had the ability, because of all the rich traditions of creating something out of nothing in Africa, to create a cuisine that is delicious and highly marketable, as you can see, because people are still eating it and paying for it. So that's my thing with soul food. One, it's sort of a disrespectful way of lumping hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of years of culinary contributions into this sort of, oh, well, you know, that's just what black people eat. It's not good for you. It's not healthy. It's, you know, when in reality, African-American cuisines, African cuisines have impacted every place that Africans were enslaved. And we were enslaved pretty much where. And most of the time we were in either the fields or the kitchens or both. And you know, if you cooked anything, if you give me some ingredients, I'm gonna cook them the way that I cook them. And so that's why when you go to places like South America, which had a huge, huge slavery population, and a lot of the dishes are basically African dishes that have been infused with Brazilian ingredients to create a whole different cuisine. And you find that not only in Africa, but you find that in the Caribbean, you find that in Europe, you find that in New Orleans, you find that in the South, you find that in the North. But we don't get any credit for it.
Well, Miss Medeiros has some really strong feelings on this subject, obviously. And if you think about it, a lot of the recipes, they aren't really given the credit, and she expands on that.
It's not referred to as African American cuisine. None of the culinary contributions that these African slave cooks made are noted. And typically, if you look even in Southern cookbooks, it'll be, this is a recipe I got from my aunt, blah, blah, blah. This is a recipe I got from Miss Jenny or something. And those were their cooks. And so they were taking these recipes from their cooks and putting them in their like junior league cookbooks, or, you know, my mammy used to make this for, it's mind blowing. And even the reason why we have cookbooks is directly attributed in some forms to the end of slavery, because the cooks left the kitchen. These women were left with no way to know how to recreate these dishes. And so a lot of the popularity of cookbooks was even due to the fact that there was a void in the market, because we didn't have to cook for you anymore. And so we were going off and doing our businesses or taking care of our own families or working or doing whatever we were, but we weren't in the kitchens anymore. So a lot of the popularity of cookbooks and the need to try to gather this information was due to the fact that slavery was over with and we didn't have to be in those kitchens anymore.
That part of the conversation was my favorite, because she had put this cookbook notion into perspective for me. I thought that I had done, you know, enough research and about what African American food is, but I never thought about the cookbooks, the recipes that so many slaves inspired and even created.
Yeah, and like earlier, Angela touches on this topic of calling African American cuisine soul food, and she explains why.
A lot of times when I'm talking about I'm asked about what I cook and why I cook it, I really want to pay tribute to those Africans and African American women and men who for years created a fabulous cuisine that has gone totally unheralded for the most part. And just to lump it into what you would call something like soul food and immediately start thinking about barbecue and, you know, what fried fish or whatever it is almost insulting to the way that they were able to take sometimes a little of nothing and create something that we still, you know, relish today. And this whole farm to table movement that everyone's so thrilled about, this is just what we did. I mean, even at the worst parts of slavery, most of the African captives had some sort of garden, or they could look at different vegetation and know that they could cook that. And they knew how to infuse flavor in food. That song, Hambone, Hambone, Where Have You Been? Around the Quarters and Back Again.
Hambone, Hambone, where's your wife? In the kitchen, cooking right. Hambone!
They knew that even the marrow of that bone, even there wasn't that much meat on it, would still add some flavor to whatever it was they're cooking. So they would share it with their neighbors when they got something like that. It's a rich history that has not really gotten the due and has really been ripped off, and a market has been created around something without giving recognition to the people who created it.
So, Jackie, I'm never going to think about ham bone the same again. It's pretty sad, but also empowering to learn the history of the song. And even when given nothing, slaves made something, and they remain resilient, of course, as always.
Definitely. And that just, you know, like you said, as always, it speaks to our history. But Dalia, I loved how she slipped the farm to table concept into the conversation, because I think we sometimes forget that historically a lot of Black people weren't casually just going to the supermarket. They were going into their own yards because that's what we have. And, you know, with everyone going green now, farm to table is kind of, people think of that as a new thing, but it really isn't.
One of my books is called The Ethnic Vegetarian.
Yeah.
The history really of vegan and ethnic cuisine is more towards the fact that most non-white people didn't eat a lot of meat.
Yeah.
That's a European concept. We didn't eat a lot of meat. I mean, we got meat for celebrations. We had meat for, you know, maybe occasionally if somebody brought back something. But even my family, who are farmers, you didn't sit down and have meat every day.
Yeah.
That's not how we ate. We were pretty much vegetarian. Most non-white cultures, because of the fact that, one, we don't, there's not a lot of land in some of the spots to raise cattle, and you don't have the money to do that sort of thing, your diet is going to be pretty much vegetable-based. Huh. So one time I was looking at a series of ethnic a series of vegetarian cookbooks from around the world. Mm-hmm. And so I was looking at it, and they had a little cookbook from Japan and China and all these different places. And so I didn't find one for Africa. So I called the editor and I said, you know, you have this series around the world with vegetarian cuisines, and you don't have Africa. She said, well, we didn't think that would sell. I'm like, how could you leave out an entire continent where pretty much that's the birthplace of most of these vegetarian dishes were that's the birthplace of those. So I just wrote my own. So I don't consider it a bad thing. Yeah. And I learned that in, to my mind, the reason why we could even endure the hardships of the Middle Passage, where you're out to get some water and all of a sudden you're herded up with a bunch of people taken from the place of your birth, put in a hold of a ship for 3 months in shackles, crammed up, maybe getting a little bit of air, hardly any food. How could you survive that if you weren't healthy to begin with? I mean, there's no way you could survive that unless you were basically healthy to begin with. You would have to be. And you would have to have the stamina and the fortitude to be able to survive. You'd never survive. You know, in order to be able to withstand working from sun up to sundown and not die in that heat, and plus all the mental things that would be going on if you were taken from your home and separated from your family and all those things, who could survive that? And that's why I take offense when people don't give the proper credit to all those generations of people who not only built the American cuisine, the foundations parts of it, but also built this country. you know, I really take offense at that. It needs to be heralded. It needs to be celebrated. It needs to be recognized. It needs to be written more about. It needs to be put into the same, you know, culinary, you know, halls of fame as French cooking and Italian cooking and, you know, any other nationality of cooking.
Now, Jackie, I kind of pushed back on Miss Medeiros about not wanting to call soul food soul food. And I wanted to see what her argument would be for someone who may have a different perception of what the word means. And this is what she said.
Because if you're lumping all the stuff that people ate because they were trying to survive, I mean, you know, if all you're going to get is some chitlins and that's all you're going to get, you're going to eat it. I don't like chitlins, but if that's all I had to eat, I'm going to eat it. And if you, the only way you can make a living is by selling barbecue plates, that's what you're going to do. But that doesn't mean that that's the history of your cuisine. It just means that this is what we did. And we knew we could make businesses out of this. We knew that this was a connection to our own people and to other people. We knew that it was marketable. And, you know, bottom line is that many, many, many Africans who were coming out of slavery made their living by selling food, you know, by going into the service industry, even the whole thing, the whole stereotype with watermelons, that what we called watermelons in our community during slavery and the aftermath of slavery during the emancipation times were freedom melons, because a lot of African Americans could get a little time, and if they had a little patch of land, they were allowed to go sell the melons on the market. And they saved that money, and a lot of them purchased their own freedom and the freedom of their families by selling watermelons. So this big stereotype about us loving watermelons, yeah, I love some watermelons too. Probably a lot of my family were able to escape slavery from that. Of course you would love it. And plus, this was a crop that we grew in Africa. This was a crop that shows you the wisdom of the African captives, because if you're working in that hot sun all day long, you're going to get dehydrated, you're going to get depleted, and there was no Gatorade that you could just go and grab. Watermelons were pretty much the Gatorade of slaves. It was cool, it was refreshing, it nourished your body, it had a lot of good minerals, and so it's a lot of just underlying racism, as with most things in America. I mean, and the more you try to deny it, the more glaring it is. It's a lot of underlying racism, and that's my issue with the term soul food. If you can make something less than, if you can make something seem like this is a horrible cuisine, if it's so horrible and so unhealthy, then why don't you take it apart and really look at it? Because the reason why a lot of things are used in African-American cuisine from the point of us arriving in America up until now were things that added flavor to bitter greens, or they were things that could stretch, or things that were inexpensive, or things that we were just given that were just pieces and parts left over from the master's house or whatever. But we had the creative genius in order to make those things palatable and delicious and marketable.
Wow, Dalia, that I never thought of it that way. Wow.
I know, Jackie. I know.
I know. So my favorite part about it, though, was her addressing the watermelon stereotype.
Yes, I know. I don't even think of them the same anymore, especially in regard to racism. The fact that these fruits were sort of like life-sustaining really had me shook.
But Dalia, I'm glad you asked her about the unhealthy aspect of African-American cuisines. I feel like that's exactly what people think of. They think about high blood pressure, heart disease, diabetes, when you think of this kind of cuisine. And actually, my mom just got diagnosed with high blood pressure last week. So this is kind of like, wow, is it the food or is it genetics even sometimes?
Well, fun fact, I actually have high blood pressure problems myself. And so I have to watch a lot of these salts as well. But I really love black food.
But maybe if you look at Miss Medeiros' cookbook, you could find you some healthy recipes.
Yes, and that's exactly what she showed me when she was cooking for me.
When I was doing research for the ethnic vegetarian, I wasn't surprised, you know, really, that so many dishes that we eat commonly, jambalaya, just different, you know, dishes that we eat all the time, are so easy to transition into something that doesn't have to have meat in it, because they are, we were used to, hey, you got some meat today? No. You need to eat? Yes. So those dishes were really, really easy to make into just an all-vegetarian cuisine. And a lot of parts of Africa are non-meat eaters because of their religious beliefs. So there's a multitude of recipes that were created by non-whites to satisfy the requirements of their religion, but also to have something that's really delicious. You know, a lot of them believe that after a fasting period, you have a feasting period. And so there's beautiful dishes that you can use for that. They're recipes that obviously were created because, you know, times were hard and there just wasn't anything else available, but they're still delicious. And that's, so I pretty much did the ethnic vegetarian cookbook the same way that I did the African American kitchen. I started in Africa, went to the Caribbean, and went to the South, pretty much the layout is basically kind of the same, because it was so easy to find all those markers of African cooks creating this dish in their own way and using the ingredients that they were familiar with and spicing them up, using peppers and tomatoes. And even in this country, for a long time, people thought tomatoes were poisonous, so they weren't even using tomatoes. I remember reading a story about a man in the 1900s, who put out a newspaper advertisement and said that he was going to eat a tomato on the steps of the courthouse. And people gathered to see if he was going to die or not. Because people didn't eat tomatoes. They thought they were poisonous. There's just a lot of things like that. A lot of people thought eggplants were poisonous. So, I mean, eggplants are in the nightshade family, so there is, you know, that. But they're not poisonous, obviously. So, but we knew, you know, we knew how to use these different things. We knew how to season them. We knew how to cook them. We knew how to preserve them. We knew how to use all these different types of foods. So when you just say soul food and just lump stuff into a barbecue category, that's why I find it so offensive, because it's so broad.
So then where fats and salt? You know, when did that start?
If you look at Southern food in general.
Yeah.
I mean, you know, you can't just say, African. Southern food is generally fat, salt, sugar. And why? Because they taste good. They're really delicious. Fried foods, crisp, brown, and delicious. Delicious. Is it great for you if you're going to eat it every day? No. So you can't just say, you know, why? It's a cultural thing. You know, and that's why I said soul food is so limiting, because
that's what you think about.
It's the food of the South.
Like, I'm not a salad eating country bumpkin myself. And the thought of having to eat salads all the time, you know, throws me all the way off. And it makes me even more hungry just thinking about it.
Definitely. My friend, I have a coworker and she's gluten free. So every time we go to lunch, she takes me to these gluten restaurants. And she took me to a place and I'm like, this is delicious. But I was hungry 15 minutes later. she took me to Salada as well. Have you been to Salada?
No,
and
but
Salada was actually really good.
But listen,
I just don't feel comfortable paying $12. I don't feel
$12 for a salad. Let me tell you where you messed up. The fact you messed up when you went into a restaurant named after a salad. That's where you messed up.
I mean, true. They have soups as well, but the soups weren't my kind of thing. But yeah.
Wow.
Okay. But Snap Kitchen, which was made in Austin, that's where she took me the first time. And that's a lot of gluten-free food. It was delicious. I was just hungry again.
I'm pretty sure. I'm glad you had fun. Anyway, Jackie, I forgot to mention that I ate tofu for the second time in my life. And it was in macaroni. Bro, and let me say it again. It was in macaroni. And it was
I don't know how I feel about
that. I know. But it was actually really delicious.
I use soft silken tofu a lot, and something like macaroni and cheese, something like soft silken tofu is really good because it has no flavor, and what it does is it absorbs all the flavors of the cheeses without
without you needing as much. Yeah. In other words, so say you use 50% soft silk and tofu and 50% of the cheeses. So the calories are going to go down in by half. Mm-hmm. The flavor is still going to be the same because this tofu is masquerading as cheese.
Yeah.
It's still going to have the mouthfeel. I'll let you taste it. It's still going to have the mouthfeel. But it takes a lot of time. And I've been doing this for a long time.
But African-American cuisine takes a long time, doesn't it?
No.
Well, yeah. I feel like every time I read a definition, it's always defined as cooking for longer periods of time.
Isn't that the definition of most things before? That's the definition of most comfort foods.
Yeah.
Cooking for a long period of time.
Yeah.
But we have microwaves now.
Mm.
Yeah. Yeah. What other choice do they have? They had, whatever. You had to cook stuff from a long... You're cooking on a wood stove? Yeah, it's going to take a long time.
Yeah.
We have microwaves. We have convection ovens.
Yeah.
We have toaster ovens. It doesn't have to take that long anymore, but you have to know what you're doing.
Yeah. Do they have tofu in it?
I'm not even going to dignify that remark.
And I don't even like tofu. But
you can't taste
soft
silk. You cannot taste soft silk and tofu.
So
I know. God. And it's easy. That particular recipe, all I do is I cook the noodles and all the ingredients in a pot at the same time. I don't boil the noodles in advance.
Mm-hmm.
This is the quickest, easiest recipe. I'll send it to you.
Mm-hmm.
It's the quickest way to make macaroni and cheese.
Mm-hmm.
And it tastes like that Blue Box brand.
Yeah.
You know.
Crap.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. It tastes like that.
No, it tastes better.
It tastes better than that, but I'm just saying the creaminess, the mouthfeel, that's what people are looking for.
This is kind of better than my mama's.
Oh, she's not listening.
No, I'm not putting this part in there.
Oh, no, don't put that part in there. You ain't going to be able to go home for Thanksgiving. You know how those people up in East Texas feel about their food.
You're right. Yeah, you're
girl,
right.
You ain't going to be able to go home ever. Oh, so you go to Miss Angela's then. You like her food? Go to Miss Angela's.
She's like, no, ma'am. Nope. This is really good.
It is really good. Okay, so here's the trick to... Watch now, baby.
They're so good. I'm sorry.
Okay, here's the trick to grits. You're going to make it rain. So I'm just gently whisking and shaking the grits and whisking. So it's kind of like a little rainfall effect.
Mm-hmm.
So that they don't clump together.
Mm-hmm.
And then I'm going to season it with, I have a spice mix that I season it with. And like I said, the reason why we have this in a, oh, is all my water gone? Lord have mercy. Hold on.
The whole point of the double boiler is to have the water. It all boiled away. It took so long for the thing to...
Okay. So anyway, I don't think I have any tofu to throw in this, but I'm going to put the cheese in it.
Yes, ma'am.
Because the rest of the ingredients aren't too bad. I mean, the shrimp's not too bad.
Mm-hmm.
And that's basically it. This is shrimp with vegetables. And then we'll put it on top of a little bit of grits.
Okay.
It won't be too bad for you. So, yeah. So, you just keep stirring this. And this what this does is the starches and the grits start to ooze out. That's what makes it creamy. So, every few minutes, we'll come back over and visit this. And I don't think I'm putting any milk in it today. I'm going to put a little bit of butter.
Mm-hmm.
And I'll put some cheese.
And you didn't even measure that at all, did you?
It was about a tablespoon.
Okay.
For four servings, which is not bad.
Okay.
Like a teaspoon per serving or so. Okay, so that'll be good for a minute. So I'm going to start building a plate. So this is not a traditional sauce for the shrimp and grits. Most of the time with shrimp and grits, they don't really make a tomato-based sauce, but I like a tomato-based sauce for my shrimp and grits.
Yeah. Does it add just like a little tang or something on there?
Well, I like it because I use salsa, and so there's bell peppers and onions and all that kind of stuff already in the salsa.
Mm-hmm.
And instead of having to use a whole lot of floury gravy and stuff, and you know, because sometimes people make like a little roux and then they start adding stuff to it to make a like a little gravy for your shrimp. That avoids all that. Mm-hmm. And so there's not going to be as many calories in it mm-hmm. as there would be if you did it the traditional way with a whole lot of butter mm-hmm. and lemon, or if you're going to do a tomato based one, a whole lot of oil and stuff. It just kind of, I just try to save calories where I can and cut down on the sodium where I can and still make it taste like the original.
Now, Dalia, like, let's keep it real, because that's what we do on To and Fro. Was it really good, or were you just being nice? This is Jackie. A safe space. Be honest. Be honest.
Okay, look. I don't lie about food. You know, I hope my mom really, like, doesn't listen to this. You know how your family claims to support you, but they really don't. I really hope she's in that phase okay. of support. Because, I might get popped, you know, if she hears me say that it was actually kind of better than her own macaroni. Ooh. But, like, you keep that on the down low. Ooh. Yeah, I know.
You're not going to be invited to no more holidays, girl. But wait, did y'all finish the shrimp and grits recipe, though?
Girl, yes, ma'am.
I think that's good. Okay. So let's put it together. Okay. So what I do when I'm making shrimp and grits, the reason why a lot of people, when they get it the next day, it's not that great, because you can't keep cooking the shrimp over and over. You can't keep reheating the shrimp. Mm-hmm. It'll turn into little rubber balls.
Yeah.
So I just barely cook the shrimp the first time, and I keep it to itself. Then I make the sauce separate, and I make the grits separate. And then when I put it together, I heat up the sauce and the grits until they're warm. And then I add the shrimp, cook it for just like barely a minute. It's delicious. It tastes like I just made it, but I didn't. So that's my secret to being able to have shrimp and grits. And if you're making large quantities, say like you wanted to have it for a dinner party, or you know, I do these, my sister and I do these little shishi poo-poo clear cups, and we put the grits in the bottom, and we put the sauce, and we put the shrimp on top, and people just lose their mind, because when do you get that? That makes it an easier way to do it if you wanted to do it for an hors d'oeuvre, if you wanted to do it, you know, a day in advance. You can do it like, is that too much for you?
No.
This is your plate. It ain't mine.
This is really good. Mm-hmm. I would have never thought to put the tomato base like sauce with it.
Mm-mm. Yeah, you don't have to worry about all that butter and fat.
Yeah.
And then when you reheat it, it kind of rehydrates everything.
Mm-hmm.
I guess it wasn't made to, people weren't thinking about, we're not going to eat. People don't eat like this anymore, where you're going to sit down and clean out
mm-hmm.
six servings. So I had to figure out a way to reheat, because it's just two of us. We're not going to eat all that.
Yeah.
I mean, and if we did, we wouldn't be having an interview.
Yeah.
We'd have been exploded by now.
So, Dalia, what is your perception on soul food now?
I think that my perception of soul food has always been the same, that it's something that's beautiful, it's something that's delicious. But I kind of never really thought, I thought about the historical aspects of it, but I never thought about the historical aspects of it here in this country and how much we contributed and how we don't necessarily think about this amazing type of food as a cuisine like you would think like Italian food or you would think like Chinese food. How about you?
Definitely. I agree with you. I've always thought of soul food as just kind of like a retrospective, like how I mentioned earlier, it's just like a thing that you do with your family. And I've heard comedians, like I've heard Chris Rock joke about it, about how Black people, we don't even really have our own food. It was just something that we had to come up with on our own because of this is what was given to us. And we just made the best out of it. But hearing it was different, hearing that actually the actual facts and hearing the way that she said it, and it just put things in a different perspective for me.
Thanks for coming to this cookout today. We would like to thank Sister Candy for making the collard greens, even though there's a few bugs that I saw still floating around in that pot, and Auntie May,
you know,
for making the pig's feet, even though the kid's 14 and under probably ain't gonna eat that pig's feet. Also, thank you, Uncle Roy Lee, for making the hoe cakes, although it has a bad word in it, and I always get popped by Grandma Jessa Lee for asking for some. And Sister Annie Mae is going to lead the prayer.
Giving honor to God, Passer, everyone's. And I would just like to thank God for allowing us to come to this cookout today. And, you know, thank everyone and the hands that prepared the food. But I would just like to say, and it came on my spirit, and God told me to tell this to y'all, that Big Mama, she killed herself, y'all. Lord. Yes, she did.
She's starting again.
She did not take her insulin. She cooked the same sugary and salty food every week that her family allowed her. They condoned it because they sat there at the table right with her. They sat there at the table with her and let her eat it. And she cooked it after she was in the hospital. On her deathbed, she continued to eat the food, and her family continued to eat the food after the fact, and they killed the food that killed their grandmother. It suggests that we should let people treat us like trash and welcome them into our homes because they're our relatives. Cousin Faith couldn't have stayed at my house. They ignored the mental issues from their uncle. He needed to be in a home, but they didn't want to do it. I would wrap that baby Ahmad in his prayers, but honestly, he didn't stay out of grown folks' business. He was always in a room when he wasn't supposed to be in a room. He was too grown, talking back, and I always got something to say. And the Lord wanted me to give this to you guys. And I want you to receive it and think about that as you consume the same sugary and salty food that killed Big Mama. In Jesus' name, there is no other name. Amen.
All right, so we're at the end of the show. So, Dalia, what was your to and fro moment this week?
I think mine this week would have to be that I think that sometimes we get so consumed in ourselves, and sometimes we forget that there are actually people watching us, and there are people that we inspire, and that there's always going to be somebody rooting for you, even though you don't see it every day. And sometimes you're reminded of that, and it's a very fulfilling feeling, I guess. So what about you?
I think mine this week would have to be never to give up on a situation too soon. Because I've often been gone into situations and been like, I don't want to do this, and I'm defeated, and I have a defeated attitude. And that often shows, even when you think it doesn't, and how sometimes your initial thoughts may come back and like bite you in the butt, and you realize that you were completely wrong. And, you know, and you were just wrong about a situation. So never go into a situation expecting the worst or just like with a bad attitude.
Exactly. Oh my gosh, that was such a great to and fro moment, friend.
Thanks. Yours too.
Thanks.
You always need people rooting in your people. Everybody's always watching, whether you know it.
Yeah, I'm always rooting for you, Shawty. Always you, remember that.
But you wanna, I am rooting for you as well. But you wanna know a good example
what?
Of that? When you put a video up on Instagram and you only get 91 likes, but you got 366.
Somebody
views.
Always watching you.
Somebody always.
That's
watching.
That's that Southern philosophy right there. That's what I'm talking
Amen.
About. Well, that's the end of the show.
Make sure to tell your friends about us and follow us on Twitter at @TheToAndFro and like us on Facebook.
This beautiful theme music was by Miss Honey Banks. Follow her on Twitter at Miss Chris Honey B.
Show us some love. Show us some love. Dalia, do you have something to leave the peoples with today?
Yes. Don't ever let your dreams disappear like a fart in a fan factory.
You need help.
I know.